Your Imperial Majesty is very noble and generous. If I might make a request...
Speak.
I'd like to be able to stay here. Here, in Don Rowan, with Lady Stella.
He wasn't surprised. He'd sensed something like that. Tact restrained him from asking questions that would have been humiliating for them both. I gave my word, he said coldly. Let your wish come true.
Thank you, Your Imperial Majesty.
I gave my word, he repeated, trying hard to avoid her gaze, and I shall keep it. I think, nonetheless, that you've made a bad choice. You gave voice to the wrong wish. Were you to change your mind?
I shall not, she said, when it became clear that the Emperor was not going to complete his sentence. Why should I? I've chosen Lady Stella. I've chosen things I have known so little of in my life. A home. Warmth. Goodness. Kindness. You can't make a mistake by choosing something like that.
Poor, naive creature, thought Emperor Emieva Emrys Daithwen Adhan in Karn Ap Moesvoth, the white flame dancing on the barrows of his enemies. By choosing something like that, one can make the most awful mistakes. But something, perhaps a distant memory, stopped the Emperor from saying it aloud.
Interesting, said Nemu, after listening to the account. An interesting dream, indeed. Were there any others?
And some.
Convirimuas cut off the top of her egg with a swift, sure movement of her knife.
My head's still spinning from that pageant, but that's normal. The first night always brings deranged dreams. You know, Nemu, they say about us dream readers that our talent isn't about being able to dream. If you pass over visions during trances or under hypnosis, our dreams don't differ from other people's in intensity, richness, or procognitive content. Something quite different distinguishes us and determines our talent. We remember the dreams. We seldom forget what we have dreamed.
The Lady of the Lake cut her off. Because your endocrine glands function in some abnormal way, your dreams, to trivialize them somewhat, are nothing more than endorphin released into the body. Like most native magical gifts, yours is mundanely organic. But why am I talking about something you know perfectly well yourself? Go on. What other dreams do you remember?
A young lad.
Kandurumuas frowned,
wandering among desolate fields with a bundle over his shoulder. The fields are barren. It's spring. Willows by the roads and on the balks. Willows, twisted, full of hollows, spreading their branches. Naked, not yet in leaf. The lad is walking, looking around. Night falls. Stars appear in the sky. One of them is moving. It's a comet, a reddish, twinkling spark, cutting slantways across the horizon.
Well done, Nemu smiled. Although I have no idea who you were dreaming about, we can at least precisely determine the date of the event. The red comet was visible for 6 days in the spring of the year the Sintran Peace was signed. To be more precise, in the first days of March.
Did any date markers appear in the other dreams? My dreams, snapped Convirimuas, salting her egg, are not a farmer's calendar. They don't have charts with dates. But to be precise, I dreamed a dream about the Battle of Brenna after having a good look at the canvas of Nikolai Chertosa in your gallery. And the date of the Battle of Brenna is also known. It's the same date as the year of the comet. Am I wrong?
You aren't. Was there anything special in the dream about the battle?
No. A seething mass of horses, people and weapons. Soldiers were fighting and yelling. Someone, probably a bit dim, was wailing, "Eagles, eagles!"
What else? You said it was a whole pageant of dreams.
I don't remember.
Convirimuas broke off. Nemu smiled.
Oh, all right.
The novice lifted up her nose haughtily, not letting the Lady of the Lake make a spiteful remark.
I occasionally forget, naturally. No one's perfect. I repeat, my dreams are visions, not library cards.
I know, interrupted Nemu.
This isn't a test of your dream-reading abilities. It's an analysis of a legend, of its mysteries and gaps. We're doing pretty well, as a matter of fact. In the first dreams, you already identified the girl in the portrait, Ceres Double, with whom Vilgefortz tried to hoodwink Emperor Emir. They stopped, because the Fisher King had entered the kitchen. After bowing and grunting, he took a loaf of bread, a tureen and a small linen bundle. He went out, not forgetting to bow and grunt.
"He's limping badly," said Nemu,
seemingly offhandedly.
"He was seriously wounded. A wild boar gashed open his leg during a hunt. That's why he spends so much time in the boat. When he's rowing and catching fish, the wound doesn't bother him. In the boat, he forgets about his disability. He's a very decent and good man, and I..."
Condwirrimuirs remained politely silent.
"Need a man," explained the small sorceress bluntly.
"Me too," thought the novice. "Damn it, as soon as I get back to the academy, I'll let someone take me. Celibacy is good, but for no longer than a semester."
Nemu cleared her throat.
"If you've broken your fast and finished daydreaming, let's go to the library.
Let's get back to your dream." Nemu opened a portfolio, flicked through several sepia watercolours, and took one of them out. Condwirrimuirs recognised it at once.
"The audience at Loch Grimm?"
"Of course. The double is being presented at the Imperial Court. Emir pretends he's been tricked, puts a brave face on it. Here, look, the ambassadors of the Northern Kingdoms, for whom the charade is being played out. Here, in turn, we see the Nilfgaardian dukes who have suffered an affront. The Emperor spurned their daughters, disregarding their dynastic proposals. Greedy for revenge, they whisper, leaning towards each other. They're hatching a plot and a murder. The double stands with her head bowed, and the artist, to underscore the mystery, has even decorated her with a handkerchief to hide her facial features. And we know nothing more about the bogus Ciri," continued the sorceress a moment later. "None of the legend's versions tell us what became of the double afterwards."
"It's safe to guess, though," said Condwirrimuirs sadly, "that the girl's fate was unenviable. When Emir obtained the original, and we know he did, don't we? He got rid of the counterfeit. When I dreamed, I didn't sense tragedy. And actually, I ought to have sensed something if... On the other hand, what I see in dreams is not necessarily the real truth. Like anybody, I dream dreams. Desires, longings, and fears. I know."
They talked until lunchtime, looking through portfolios and fascicles of prints. The Fisher King had been lucky with his catch, because there was grilled salmon for lunch. For supper, too. Condwirrimuirs slept badly that night. She had overeaten. She didn't dream anything. She was a little downhearted and embarrassed about that, but Nemu wasn't at all concerned.
"We have time," she said. "There are plenty of nights ahead of us."
The Tower of Innisvitra had several bathrooms, truly luxurious, shining with marble and glistening with brass, heated by a hypocaust, located somewhere in the cellars. Condwirrimuirs had no problem occupying the baths for hours, but every now and again would meet Nemu in the sweat house, a tiny wooden hut with a jetty leading out towards the lake. They would sit on benches, wet, inhaling the steam that belched from stones sprinkled with water, swishing themselves lazily with birch twigs as salty sweat dripped into their eyes.
"If I understood right," Condwirrimuirs wiped her face, "my practice here in Innisvitra is meant to explain all the gaps in the legend of the Witcher and the Witcher Girl?"
"That's right."
"During the day, by looking at the prints and discussing them, I'm meant to charge myself up before sleep, in order at night to be able to dream the real, unknown version of a given event."
This time, Nemu didn't even consider it necessary to concur. She just beat herself a few times with the whisk, stood up, and splashed water on the hot stones. The steam billowed, and the heat stopped their breath for a moment. Nemu poured the rest of the water on herself from a small wooden pail. Condwirrimuirs admired her figure.
Although petite, the sorceress was extremely well proportioned. A woman in her 20s would have envied her curves and firm skin. Kundwurimur's, for example, was 24 and was envious.
"Even if I explain anything," she continued, wiping her sweaty face again, "how will we be certain I'm dreaming the true version? I truly didn't know."
"We'll discuss that outside," interrupted Nemo. "I've had enough of sitting in this heat. Let's cool off, and then we'll talk."
That was also part of the ritual. They ran from the sweat house, bare feet slapping on the planks of the jetty, and they leapt into the lake, yelling wildly. After splashing around, they climbed out onto the jetty, squeezing their hair. The Fisher King, alarmed by the splashes and squeals, looked around from his boat and glanced at them, shielding his eyes with a hand. But he turned around at once and scrutinized his fishing tackle. Kundwurimur's considered behavior like that insulting and reprehensible. Her opinion of the Fisher King had improved greatly when she noticed that he devoted the time he wasn't angling to reading. He even took a book with him to the privy, and it was no less than Speculum Aureum, a serious and demanding work. So, even if during the first days of her stay in Innis Vitra, Kundwurimur's had been somewhat surprised at Nemo keeping him around, she had stopped long since. It became clear that the Fisher King was only seemingly a lout and a boor, or it was a mask he hid behind. All the same, thought Kundwurimur's, it was an insult and an unforgivable affront to turn back towards one's rods and spinners when two naked women with bodies like nymphs to whom one's eyes should have been glued were parading on a jetty.
"If I dream something," she said, going back to the subject and drying herself with a towel, "what guarantee is there I dreamed the true version? I know all the literary versions of the legend, from Dandelion's Half a Century of Poetry to Andrei Ravix's The Lady of the Lake. I know the Honourable Yara. I know all the scholarly treatments, not to mention popular editions. Reading all those texts has left a mark, had an influence. I'm unable to eliminate them from my dreams. Is there any chance of breaking through the fiction and dreaming the truth?"
"Yes, there is."
"How great."
"The same chance the Fisher King has."
Nemo nodded towards the boat on the lake.
"As you can see, he keeps on casting his hooks. He catches waterweed, roots, submerged tree stumps, logs, old boots, drowned corpses, and the devil knows what else. But from time to time, he catches something worthwhile."
"So, I wish us good hunting," sighed Kundwurimur's, dressing. "Let's cast the bait and fish. Let's search for the true versions of the legend. Let's unstitch the upholstery and lining, and let's tap the chest for a false bottom. And what will happen if there isn't a false bottom? With all due respect, Nemo, we aren't the first in these fishing grounds. What chance is there that any detail or particular has escaped the attention of the hordes of scholars who fished it before us, that they've left us even a single fish?"
"They have," stated Nemo with conviction, combing out her wet hair. "What they didn't know, they plastered over with confabulation and purple prose, or drew a veil over it.
For instance, the sojourn of the Witcher in Toussaint, to give the first example that comes to mind. All the versions of the legend dismiss that episode with a curt sentence. The protagonists wintered in Toussaint. Even Dandelion, who devoted two chapters to his exploits in that country, is astonishingly enigmatic on the subject of the Witcher. Would it not then be worth finding out what happened that winter, after the flight from Belhaven and the meeting with the elf Avalach in the subterranean complex of Tírnabe Arraina, after the skirmish in Caed Murchfyn with the Druids? What did the Witcher do in Toussaint from October to January?"
"What did he do? He wintered," snorted the novice.
"He couldn't cross the pass before the thaw, so he wintered and got bored. No wonder later authors treated that boring fragment with a laconic, 'The winter passed.'"
"Well, since I must, I'll try to dream something. Do we have any pictures or drawings?"
Nemo smiled.
"We even have a drawing on a drawing." The cave painting depicted a hunting scene. A large purple bison was being pursued in wild leaps by skinny human figures with bows and spears painted with careless brush strokes. The bison had tiger stripes, and something resembling a dragonfly was hovering above its lyre-shaped horns.
"So this," Regis nodded, "is that wall painting, executed by the elf Avila, the elf who knew a great deal."
"Yes," Geralt confirmed dryly. "That's the painting."
"The problem is that we thoroughly explored these caves, but there are no traces of any elves or the other creatures you mentioned."
"They were here. Now they've hidden themselves. Or decamped."
"That's an indisputable fact. Don't forget, you were only given an audience after the Flaminica's intercession. It was clearly decided that one audience would suffice. Now that the Flaminica has refused cooperation quite categorically, I truly know not what else you can do. We've been dragging ourselves through these caves all day. I can't help feeling it's pointless."
"Me too," the Witcher said bitterly. "I can't either. I've never understood elves, but at least I know why most people aren't fond of them, because it's difficult not to feel that they're mocking us. The elves mock us, deride us in everything they do, say and think, scoff at us."
"It's your anthropomorphism talking."
"Perhaps a little, but the impression remains."
"What do we do?"
"We return to Caid Mirkvid and Cair. The druidesses have probably patched up his scalped pate. Then we mount our horses and take advantage of Princess Anna Henrietta's invitation. Don't make faces, vampire. Milver has a few broken ribs. Cair's nut has been split open, so a little rest in Toussaint will do both of them good. We also have to untangle Dandelion from this business, because it looks like he's well and truly caught up."
"Very well," sighed Regis. "Let it be. I'll have to steer clear of looking glasses and dogs, watch out for sorcerers and telepaths, and if in spite of that they unmask me, I'm counting on you."
"You can," Geralt responded gravely. "I won't abandon you in need, comrade."
The vampire smiled, and because they were alone, showed his full set of fangs.
"Comrade?"
"It's my anthropomorphism talking. On we go. Let's get out of these caverns, comrade, because all we'll find here is rheumatism."
"I agree. Unless... Geralt. Tierna Bea Arina, the elven necropolis, according to what you saw, is behind the cave painting, right behind that wall. We could get there if we, you know, smashed it. Haven't you thought about that?"
"No, I haven't."
The Fisher King had been lucky again, because there was smoked char for supper. Fish so tasty that the lesson wasn't learned. Condwyrimure's stuffed herself again. Condwyrimure's burped and tasted the smoked char. "Time for bed," she thought, for the second time, catching herself mechanically turning a page in the book without registering the content at all.
"Time for bed."
She yawned and put the book aside. She rearranged the pillows, changing their positions from reading to repose. She magicked the lamp off. The chamber was immediately plunged into darkness, as opaque and viscous as molasses. The heavy velour curtains were tightly drawn. The novice had long known from experience that she dreamed better in the darkness.
"What to choose?" she thought,
stretching and wriggling about on the sheets.
"Let it run its oniric course, or try to anchor myself?"
In spite of widespread assurances, dream readers didn't remember even half of their prophetic dreams, a significant proportion of which remained in the oniromancer's memory as a muddle of images, changing colour and shape like a kaleidoscope, a child's toy of mirrors and pieces of glass. Not so bad if the images were random and without even a semblance of meaning. Then one could calmly wave them aside on the basis of, "I can't remember, so it's not worth remembering." Dreams like that were called crap by dream readers. Worse, and slightly shameful, were apparitions. dreams of which dream readers only remembered fragments, only snatches of meaning, dreams after which all that remained the next morning was a vague sense of a signal having been received. If an apparition repeated itself too often, one could be certain one was dealing with a dream of significant oniric value. Then the dream reader, through concentration and autosuggestion, tried hard to force herself to re-dream the specific apparition exactly. The best results occurred by making oneself re-dream it immediately on waking, which was called snagging. If the dream couldn't be snagged, all that remained was an attempt at evoking a given dream vision during one of the next periods of sleep, by concentrating and meditating before falling asleep. That method of programming dreams was called anchoring. After 12 nights spent on the island, Condwirrmuir's already had three lists, three sets of dreams. There was a list of successes worth boasting about, a list of apparitions which the dream reader had successfully snagged or anchored. That included the dreams about the rebellion on the Isle of Thanet and the journey of the Witcher and his company through the blizzard on the Malheur Pass, through the spring downpours and soft roads in the Suduth Valley. There was also, the novice hadn't admitted to Nemu, a list of failures, dreams that in spite of her efforts still remained enigmas. And there was a list of works in progress, a list of dreams that were waiting for their turn. And there was one dream, strange but very pleasant, which kept returning in snatches and flashes, in elusive sounds and silky touches. A nice, tender dream.
"Very well," thought Condwirrmuir's, closing her eyes. "I'm ready."
"I think I know what occupied the Witcher while he wintered in Toussaint."
"Well, well."
Nemu raised her eyes from above her spectacles and the leather-bound grimoire she was leafing through.
"Have you finally dreamed something?"
"I'll say," Condwirrmuir said cockily, "I've dreamed it. The Witcher Geralt and a woman with short black hair and green eyes. I don't know who it could have been. Perhaps that Duchess Dandelion writes about in his memoirs."
"You must have been reading inattentively."
The sorceress cooled her novice's enthusiasm somewhat. "Dandelion describes Duchess Anarietta precisely, and other sources confirm that she had, and I quote, hair of chestnut tones blazing like gold itself."
"And so it isn't her," the novice agreed. "My woman had black hair, like coal itself, and the dream was... interesting."
"I'm all ears."
"They conversed, but it wasn't an ordinary conversation."
"Was there something extraordinary about it?"
"For most of it, she had her legs slung over his shoulders."
"Tell me, Geralt, do you believe in love at first sight?"
"Do you?"
"I do."
"Now I know what brought us together, the attraction of opposites."
"Don't be cynical."
"Why not? Cynicism is meant to be proof of intelligence."
"Not true. Cynicism, in spite of all its pseudo-intelligent aura, is repulsively insincere. I can't stand insincerity of any kind. Since we're on the subject, tell me, Witcher, what do you love most about me?"
"This."
"You're descending from cynicism into triviality and banality. Try again."
"The thing I love most about you is your mind, your intelligence and your spiritual profundities, your independence and freedom, your..."
"I don't understand where all this sarcasm in you comes from."
"It wasn't sarcasm. It was a joke."
"I can't bear jokes like that. Especially not at the wrong time." "Everything, my dear, has its time, and a time is set for all matters under the sun. There is a time for silence, and a time for speech, a time for weeping tears, and a time for laughter, a time for sowing, and a time for reaping, a time for jokes, and a time for gravity."
"A time for carnal caresses, and a time for refraining from them."
"Hey, don't take it so literally. Accept, rather, that there's a time for compliments. Lovemaking without compliments smacks of physiology, and physiology is shallow. Pay me compliments."
No one from the Iruga to the Bowena has such a gorgeous behind as you.
Blast it! Now for a change you've compared me to some barbaric little northern rivers. Passing over the various metaphors, couldn't you have said from the Alba to the Velde, or from the Alba to Sans Retour?
I've never seen the Alba. I try hard to avoid judgments when they aren't backed up by hard experience.
Oh, truly? Then I think you've seen and experienced enough bums, for that's what we're talking about, to be able to judge. Well, white hair, how many women have you had before me? Eh? I asked you a question, Witcher. No, no, let go, hands off, you want to wriggle out of it like that. How many women have you had before me?
None. You're my first.
At last.
Nemu stared for a long time at a painting depicting 10 women sitting at a round table in subtle chiaroscuro.
Pity, she finally said, that we don't know what they really looked like.
The great sorceresses, snorted Condwiramuse. There are dozens of portraits of them, in Aretusa alone.
I said really, interrupted Nemu. I didn't mean flattering likenesses painted on the basis of other flattering likenesses. Don't forget, there was a time when the reputations of sorceresses were maligned, as were the sorceresses themselves. And later there was the time of propaganda, when the great sorceresses must have aroused respect, admiration, and reverential fear by their very appearance. The meetings of the lodge, the conspiracies, and the convents all date from that time. Canvases and engravings showing a table, and around it 10 magnificent, enchantingly beautiful women. And there aren't any real, authentic portraits, apart from two exceptions. The portrait of Margarita Lozantila that hangs in Aretusa on the Isle of Thanet, and which miraculously survived the fire, is authentic. And the portrait of Sheila de Tankerville in Ensenada, Lanexida, is authentic. And the portrait of Francesca Finderbear, painted by elves, hanging in the Vengerberg Gallery? Asked Condwiramuse. A forgery. When the door was opened and the elves departed, they took away with them or destroyed every work of art, leaving not a single painting. We don't know if the Daisy of the Valleys was really as comely as the tales have it. We have no idea at all what Ida Imaen looked like. And since in Nilfgaard images of sorceresses were destroyed very diligently and thoroughly, we don't have any idea about the true appearances of Azirava Anahid or Fringilla Vigo.
Let's suppose and agree that they all looked exactly as they were later portrayed, sighed Conwiramuus. Dignified, imperious, good and wise, foresighted and noble. And beautiful, captivatingly beautiful. Let's suppose that. Then it's somehow easier to live.
The daily activities on Innis Vitra took on the character of a somewhat tiresome routine. The analysis of Condwiramuir's dreams beginning at breakfast usually dragged on all the way to midday. The novice spent the time between noon and their next meal taking walks, which also quickly became habitual and quite boring. No wonder. In the course of an hour, one could go around the island twice, feasting one's eyes all the while on such engrossing things as granite, a dwarf pine, pebbles, freshwater mussels, water and gulls. After lunch and a long siesta followed discussions, the inspection of tomes, scrolls and manuscripts, the study of pictures, prints and maps, and long debates about the mutual interrelationships between legend and truth extending into the night. And then the nights and dreams. Various dreams. Celibacy made itself felt. At times, instead of the mysteries of the Witcher legend, Condwiramuse dreamed of the Fisher King in all sorts of situations, from extremely non-erotic to extremely erotic. In an extremely non-erotic dream, the Fisher King was dragging her behind his boat on a rope. He was rowing slowly and languidly, so she was sinking, drowning, spluttering, and on top of that, a terrible fear was tormenting her. She felt that something had pushed off the lake bottom and was swimming up towards her. Something awful, something that wanted to swallow the bait, her being pulled behind the boat. That something was on the point of seizing her when the Fisher King leaned more heavily on the oars, pulling her out of range of the invisible predator's jaws. As she was dragged along, she choked on water, and at that moment she awoke. In an unambiguously erotic dream, she was kneeling on the bottom of the rocking boat, hanging over the side, and the Fisher King was holding her by the shoulders and fucking her exuberantly, grunting, hawking, and spitting as he did so. Apart from the physical pleasure, Condwirrimuir's felt gut-wrenching terror. What would happen if Nemu caught them at it? She suddenly saw the face of the little sorceress rocking in the lake, and she awoke, soaked in sweat. Then she got up and opened the window, luxuriated in the night air, the light of the moon and the mist rolling off the lake, and dreamed on. The Tower of Innisvitra had a terrace supported on columns suspended over the lake. At the beginning, Condwirrimuir did not pay any attention to the matter, but finally began to wonder. The terrace was strange because it was totally inaccessible. It was impossible to get onto the terrace from any of the rooms she knew. Aware that the abodes of sorceresses were sure to have such secret anomalies, Condwirrimuir did not ask any questions. Even when, as she took a walk along the lakeshore, she saw Nemu watching her from the terrace. It was inaccessible, it turned out, only to the unauthorized and the profane. Piqued that she was thought of as profane, she dug her heels in and pretended that nothing was the matter. But it wasn't long before the secret of the terrace was revealed. It was after she had been visited by a series of dreams triggered by the watercolours of Vilma Vesely. Clearly fascinated by that fragment of the legend, the artist devoted all her works to Ciri in the Tower of the Swallow. "I'm having strange dreams after those paintings," the novice complained the next morning. "I'm dreaming of paintings. Always the same paintings. Not situations, not scenes, but paintings. Ciri on the tower's battlements. An unmoving picture. And nothing else. No sensations apart from visual ones." Nemu knew, of course, that a dream reader as able as Condwirrimuir's dreamed with all her senses. She didn't only experience the dream with sight, like most people, but also with her hearing, touch, smell, even taste. "No." Condwirrimuir shook her head. "Only... yes? Yes? A thought. A stubborn thought. That by this lake, in this tower, I'm not the mistress at all, but a captive. Follow me." Just as Condwirrimuir had guessed, the way to the terrace was only possible through the sorceress's private chambers, which were utterly clean, pedantically tidy, smelling of sandalwood, myrrh, lavender, and naphthalene. They had to use a tiny door and a winding staircase leading downwards. This chamber, unlike the others, didn't have wood panelling or tapestries. It was simply painted white and was thus very bright. It was all the brighter since there was a huge triptych window, or rather a glass door, leading straight onto the terrace perched above the lake. The only pieces of furniture in the chamber were two armchairs, an immense looking glass in an oval mahogany frame, and a kind of rack with a horizontal bar and a tapestry draped over it. The tapestry measured about 5 foot by 7, and its tassels rested on the floor. It showed a rocky cliff over a tarn, and a castle carved into the cliff, which seemed to be part of the rock wall. A castle Condwirrimuir knew well from numerous illustrations. "Vilgefortz's citadel, Yennefer's place of imprisonment, the place where the legend ended." "That is so." Nemu nodded, apparently indifferently. "The legend ended there, at least in its known versions. It's those versions we know, so we think we know the ending. Ciri fled from the Tower of the Swallow, where, as you dreamed it, she had been a prisoner. When she realized what they wanted to do to her, she escaped. The legend gives many versions of her flight. The one I like most," cut in Condwirrimuir, "is the one where she threw objects behind her. A comb, an apple, and a neckerchief. But Condwirrimuir..." "I beg your pardon." "As I said, there are myriad versions of the escape. but it's still none too clear how Ciri reached Vilgefortz's castle straight from the Tower of the Swallow. You couldn't dream the Tower of the Swallow, could you? Try dreaming the castle. Examine that tapestry carefully. Are you listening to me? That looking glass. It's magical, isn't it? No, I squeeze my pimples in front of it. I beg your pardon? It's Hartmann's looking glass, explained Nemu, seeing the novice's wrinkled nose and sullen expression. Look into it if you wish, but please be cautious. Is it true? Asked Conwira Muirs, in a voice trembling with excitement. That from Hartmann's looking glass, you can pass into other worlds? Indeed, but not at once, not without preparation, meditation, concentration, and a whole host of other things. When I recommended caution, I was thinking about something else.
What?
It works both ways. Something may also emerge from Hartmann's looking glass.
Know what, Nemu? When I look at that tapestry, have there been dreams?
Yes, but strange ones, from a bird's eye view. I was a bird. I saw the castle from the outside. I couldn't go inside. Something barred my way.
Look at the tapestry, commanded Nemu. Look at the citadel. Look at it carefully. Focus your attention on every detail. Concentrate hard. Etch that image deeply into your memory. I want you to get there in your dream, to go inside. It's important for you to go inside. A truly devilish gale must have been raging outside beyond the castle walls. The fire was roaring in the grate, quickly consuming the logs. Yennefer was delighting in the warmth. Her current prison was, admittedly, much, much warmer than the dank dungeon where she had spent the last 2 months. But despite her delight, her teeth still chattered. She had completely lost track of time, and no one had hurried to inform her about the date. But she was certain it was December, or perhaps even January.
Eat, Yennefer, said Vilgefortz. Don't be shy. Tuck in.
The sorceress had no intention of being shy. If, though, she was coping quite slowly and awkwardly with the chicken, it was only because her barely healed fingers were still clumsy and stiff. It was hard work to hold a knife and fork in them, and she didn't want to eat with her fingers. She wanted to show Vilgefortz and the other diners, the sorcerer's guests, that she was stronger than they believed. She didn't know any of them.
I'm truly sorry to have to inform you, said Vilgefortz, caressing the stem of his wineglass, that Ciri, your ward, has departed this life. You only have yourself to blame, Yennefer. You and your senseless obstinacy.
One of the guests, a short, dark-haired man, sneezed loudly and blew his nose on a cambric handkerchief. His nose was red and swollen and clearly completely blocked up.
Bless you, said Yennefer,
not at all bothered by Vilgefortz's portentous words.
Where did you catch such an awful chill, good sir? Did you stand in a draught after bathing?
Another guest, old, huge, thin, with hideously pale eyes, suddenly cackled. The one with the cold, although his face contorted in anger, thanked the sorceress with a bow and a brief guttural sentence, not brief enough for her not to detect an Elfgardian accent. Vilgefortz turned his face towards her. He was no longer wearing on his head the golden scaffolding or the crystal lens in his eye socket. But he looked even more horrible than when, during the summer, she had first seen his mutilated face. His regenerated left eyeball was now functioning, but was much smaller than his right. The sight took her breath away.
You, Yennefer, he drawled, no doubt think I'm lying. Think I'm trying to ensnare you, trick you. To what end would I do that? I was as distressed as you at the news of Ciri's death. What am I saying? Even more than you. After all,
I had pinned very specific hopes on the maid, had made plans which were to have determined my future. Now the girl is dead, and my plans are ruined.
Good.
Yennefer, trying hard to hold the knife in her stiff fingers, was slicing a pork cutlet stuffed with plums.
You, though,
continued the wizard, paying no attention to her remark,
are merely connected to Ciri by sentimental attachment, which consists in equal measure of regret caused by your own barrenness and a sense of guilt. Yes, yes, Yennefer, guilt. For after all, you participated in the cross-breeding, in the animal husbandry that resulted in little Ciri's birth, and then transferred your affection onto the fruit of a genetic experiment, an unsuccessful one, which failed anyway, because the experimenters lacked in knowledge.
Yennefer raised her glass to him in silence, praying it wouldn't fall from her fingers. She was slowly coming to the conclusion that at least two of them would be stiff for a long time, possibly permanently. Vilgefortz snorted at her gesture.
Now it's too late. It's happened, he said through clenched teeth. But know this, Yennefer, that I possess knowledge. If I'd had the girl as well, I would have made use of that knowledge. Indeed, it was bad luck for you, for I would have given you a reason for your crippled excuse of a maternal instinct. Although you're as dry and sterile as a stone, you'd not only have had a daughter, but a granddaughter too. Or at least an excuse for a granddaughter.
Yennefer snorted contemptuously, although inside she was seething with fury.
With the greatest regret, I'm compelled to further spoil your splendid mood, my dear, the sorceress said coldly, because I imagine you'll be saddened to hear that the Witcher, Geralt of Rivia, is also dead. Yes, yes, the same Witcher Geralt, with whom, as with Ciri, you are bound by an ersatz emotion, a ridiculous, foolish, and sickly sweet fondness. No, Yennefer, that our dear Witcher departed from this world in a truly ardent and spectacular fashion. In this case, you don't have to reproach yourself. You're not to blame in the slightest for the Witcher's death. I'm responsible for the entire fracas. Try the marinated pears. They're simply delicious.
Cold hatred lit up Yennefer's violet eyes. Vilgefortz burst out laughing.
I prefer you like this, he said. Indeed, were it not for the dimeterium bracelet, you'd reduce me to ashes. But the dimeterium is working, so you can only scorch me with your gaze.
The man with the cold sneezed, blew his nose and coughed until tears trickled from his eyes. The tall man scrutinized the sorceress with his unpleasant, fishy gaze.
"And where is Mr. Ryance?" asked Yennefer, drawing out her words. "Mr. Ryance, who promised me so much, told me so much about what he'd do to me. Where is Mr. Skiru, who never passed up a chance to shove or kick me? Why have the guards, until quite recently boorish and brutal, begun to behave with timid respect? No, Vilgefortz, you don't have to answer. I know. What you've been talking about is one big lie. Ciri escaped you, and Geralt escaped you, taking the time, I expect, to give your thugs a bloody good hiding. And what now? Your plans have fallen through, turned to dust. You admitted it yourself. Your dreams of power have vanished like smoke. And the sorcerers and Dykstra are fixing your position. Oh, yes. Not without reason. And not from mercy have you stopped torturing me and forcing me to scan for information you need. And Emperor Emir is tightening his net and is no doubt very, very angry. Esatear smirtian, aplina akalis alea.
I use the cobbled speech, said the one with the runny nose, holding her gaze. And my name is Stefan Skelen. and by no means at all have I filled my breeches. Why, I still have the impression that I'm in a much better situation than you, Madame Yennefer.
The speech tired him. He coughed hard again and blew his nose into the sodden cambric handkerchief. Vilgefortz struck the table with his hand.
"Enough of this game," he said,
grotesquely swivelling his miniature eye.
"Know this, Yennefer. You are no longer of use to me. In principle, I ought to have you shoved in a sack and drowned in the lake, but I use that kind of method with the utmost reluctance. Until the time circumstances permit, or compel me to make another decision, you shall remain in isolation. I warn you, however, that I shan't allow you to cause me problems. If you decide to go on hunger strike again, know this, that I shall not, as I did in October, waste time feeding you through a straw. I shall simply let you starve to death. And in the case of escape attempts, the guard's orders are explicit. And now, farewell, if naturally you have satisfied your..."
"No." Yennefer stood up and hurled her napkin down onto the table. "Perhaps I would have eaten something more, but the company spoils my appetite. Farewell, gentlemen." Stefan Skelen sneezed and coughed hard. The pale-eyed man measured her with an evil look and smiled hideously. Vilgefortz looked to one side. As usual when she was led to or from the prison, Yennefer tried to work out where she was, obtain even a scrap of information that might help her to plan her escape. And each time she met with disappointment. The castle didn't have any windows through which she could see the surrounding terrain, or even the sun to try to orient herself. Telepathy was impossible, and the two heavy dimaterium bracelets on her arms and the collar around her neck effectively prevented all attempts at magic. The chamber in which she was being held was as cold and austere as a hermit's cell. Nonetheless, Yennefer recalled the joyous day when she was transferred there from the dungeon. From the dungeon, on whose floor stood a permanent puddle of stinking water, and on whose walls efflorescence and salting erupted. From the dungeon where she'd been fed on scraps that the rats easily tore from her lacerated fingers. When, after around 2 months, she had been unshackled and dragged out of there, allowed to bathe and change, Yennefer had been beside herself with happiness. The small room to which she had been transferred seemed like a royal boudoir to her, and the thin gruel they brought her like bird's nest soup fit for the imperial table. Naturally, after some time, however, the gruel turned out to be dishwater, her hard palate a hard palate, and the prison a prison. A cold, cramped prison, where after 4 paces you reached the wall. Yennefer swore, sighed, and sat down on the scissor chair, which was the only furniture she could use apart from the pallet. He entered so quietly, she almost didn't hear him.
"The name's Bonnart," he said. "I'd advise you to remember that name, which imprinted deeply in your memory."
"Go fuck yourself, you swine."
"I'm a man, Hunter."
He ground his teeth.
"Yes, yes. Listen carefully, witch. In September, 3 months ago, I hunted down your little brat in Ebbing, that Ciri of yours about whom so much is said."
Yennefer listened attentively.
"September, Ebbing, quarter. But she isn't here. Perhaps he's lying."
"An ashen-haired witcher girl, schooled at Kaer Morhen. I ordered her to fight in the arena, to kill people to the screams of the public. Slowly, slowly, I transformed her into a beast. I prepared her for that role with whip, fist, and boot heel. The training process was lengthy, but she escaped from me, the green-eyed viper."
Yennefer gasped imperceptibly.
"She escaped into the beyond. But we shall meet again. I'm certain that we shall meet again one day. Yes, witch,
And if I regret anything, it's only that they roasted your witcher lover, Geralt, in the fire. I'd have loved to let him taste my blade, the accursed freak.
Yennefer snorted.
Well, listen, Bonhart, or whatever your name is. Don't make me laugh. You're no match for the witcher. You can't compare yourself to him in any way. You are, as you admitted, a dog catcher, but only good for little curs. For very little curs.
Look here then, witch.
He tore open his jerkin and shirt and took out three silver medallions tangling at their chains. One was shaped like a cat's head, the next an eagle or a griffin. She couldn't see the third one well, but it was probably a wolf.
Country fairs, she snorted again, feigning indifference, are full of stuff like that.
They aren't from a fair.
You don't say.
Once upon a time, Bonhart hissed, decent people feared witches more than monsters. Monsters, after all, hid in forests and the undergrowth, while witches had the audacity to hang around temples, chanceries, schools and playgrounds. Decent people rightly considered that a scandal. So they looked for somebody to bring the impudent witches to order. And they found the someone. Not easily, not quickly, not nearby. But they did. As you can see, I've bagged three. No more freaks have appeared in the area or annoyed decent citizens by their presence. And were one to appear, I'd do away with him just like I did with the previous ones.
In your dreams.
Yennefer's face became contorted. With a crossbow from hiding? Or perhaps with a draught of poison? Bonhart put the medallions back under his shirt and took two paces towards her.
You vex me, witch.
That was my intention.
Oh, yes. I'll soon show you, bitch, that I can compete with your witcher lover in any way. Why? That I'm even better than him.
The guards, standing outside the door, started at the thudding, banging, crashing, howling and wailing. And if the guards had ever happened to hear before the yelling of a panther caught in a trap, they would have sworn there was a panther in the cell. Then a dreadful roar reached their ears. It was the exact sound of a wounded lion. Although the guards actually had never heard that either, only seen one on coats of arms. They looked at each other. They nodded to each other. Then they rushed inside. Yennefer was sitting in the corner of the chamber among the remains of her pallet. Her hair was dishevelled, her dress and blouse were torn from top to bottom, and her small breasts were rising in the rhythm of heavy breathing. Blood dripped from her nose, her face was quickly swelling, and welts from fingernails were also growing on her right arm. Bonhart was sitting on the other side of the chamber amongst pieces of a stool, holding his crotch in both hands. Blood was dripping from his nose too, staining his grey whiskers a deep carmine. His face was crisscrossed with bloody scratch marks. Yennefer's barely healed fingers were a poor weapon, but the padlocks on the Dimitrian bracelets had splendidly sharp edges. Both tines of the fork that Yennefer had swiped from the table during supper were rammed deep and evenly into the bone of Bonhart's swelling cheek.
"Only little curs, you dog-catcher," gasped the sorceress, trying to cover up her breasts with the remains of her dress. "And stay away from bitches. You're too weak for them, pipsqueak."
She couldn't forgive herself for not striking where she had aimed, his eye. But why? The target was moving. Besides, nobody's perfect. Bonhart roared, stood up, pulled out the fork, howled and staggered from the pain. He swore hideously. Meanwhile, two more guards looked inside the cell.
"Hey, you!" roared Bonhart, wiping blood from his face. "In here! Drag that harlot into the middle of the floor, spread eagle her and hold her down."
The guards looked at each other, then at the floor, and then at the ceiling.
"You'd better be going, sir," said one. "There won't be any spread eagling or holding here. It's not among our duties.
And apart on that, but the other, we don't mean to end up like Ryonce or Skiru.
Condwiramuirs put aside the painted board which depicted a prison cell, and in the cell, a woman sitting with head bowed, manacled to the stone wall.
"They imprisoned her," she murmured, "and the Witcher was taking his pleasure in Tucson with some brunette."
"Do you condemn him?"
Nemo asked severely,
"knowing practically nothing." "No, I don't condemn him, but there are no buts. Be quiet, please."
They sat in silence for some time, leafing through engravings and watercolours.
"All the versions of the legend,"
Condwiramuirs pointed to one of the engravings,
"give Rhys Runcastle as the place of the ending, the finale, the conclusive battle between good and evil, Armageddon. All of the versions, aside from one."
"Aside from one,"
nodded Nemo.
"Aside from an anonymous, not very popular version, known as the Black Book of Elendur.
The Black Book states that the ending of the legend played out in Stygga Citadel."
"Indeed. And the Book of Elendur presents matters that describe the legend in a way that differs significantly from the canon."
"I wonder,"
Condwiramuirs raised her head,
"which of those castles is portrayed in the illustrations? Which one is shown on your tapestry? Which likeness is true?"
"We shall never know. The castle that witnessed the ending of the legend doesn't exist. It was destroyed. Not a trace of it remains. All the versions agree on that, even the one given by the Book of Elendur. None of the locations given in the sources is convincing. We do not know, and shall not know, what that castle looked like, and where it stood. But the truth means nothing whatsoever,"
Nemo interrupted sharply.
"Don't forget, we don't know what Ciri really looked like. But look at this figure here, on this piece of parchment drawn on by Vilma Vesely in a heated conversation with the elf, Avalach, against a background of figurines of macabre children. It's her, Ciri. There isn't any doubt about it."
"But,"
Condwiramuir soldiered on pugnaciously,
"your tapestry depicts the castle where the legend's climax was played out."
There was a long silence. The sheets of parchment rustled as they were turned over.
"I don't like the version of the legend from the Black Book," Condwiramuir began. It's
brutally authentic."
Nemo finished her novice's sentence, nodding. Condwiramuirs yawned, put down an edition of Half a Century of Poetry with an afterword by Professor Everett Denhoff Jr. She plumped up her pillow, changing the arrangement for reading to one suitable for sleeping. She yawned, stretched, and blew out the lamp. The chamber was plunged into darkness, lit only by needles of moonlight squeezing through chinks in the curtains.
"What should I choose tonight?"
wondered the novice, wriggling on the sheets.
"Take potluck or anchor myself?"
After a brief moment, she decided on the latter. It was a vague, repeating dream that she couldn't see through to the end. It evaporated, vanished among other dreams, like a thread of the weft vanishes and gets lost among the pattern of a coloured fabric. A dream that vanished from her memory, but which, in spite of that, stubbornly remained in it. She fell asleep immediately, the dream engulfing her at once, as soon as she closed her eyes. A night sky, cloudless, bright from the moon and the stars. Hills, and on their slopes, vineyards, dusted with snow. The black, angular outline of a building. A wall with battlements. A keep. A lonely corner watchtower. Two horsemen. The two of them ride beyond the outer wall. They dismount. They both enter the portal, but only one of them enters the opening to a dungeon gaping in the floor, the one with utterly white hair. Condwiramuirs moaned in her sleep, tossing around on her bed. The white-haired man descends the stairs deep, deep into the cellar. He walks along dark corridors, from time to time illuminating them by lighting brands held in cast-iron cressets. The glow from the torches casts ghastly shadows on the walls and vaulting. Corridors, stairs, and again corridors. A dungeon, a huge crypt, barrels by the walls. Piles of rubble, heaps of bricks. Then a corridor which forks into two. Darkness both ways. The white